Hey everyone, welcome to Comedy History 101. This is Harmon. Hey, did you see the new Showtime documentary series on the Comedy Store? It's pretty good. In the latest episode, they talk about the infamous Comedy Store strike. Yes, comedians at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles walked out of the club and went on strike because they weren't getting paid. And in turn, it kind of changed the face of comedy as we know it today. The strike, just to give you a little teaser, was led by the likes of David Letterman, Tom Dreesen, and Jay Leno. So that's why we're bringing back this special Comedy History 101 Select on the history of the Comedy Store strike. But before we jump into the episode, take some time to like, subscribe, and comment on Comedy History 101, wherever you get your podcast. We'll even read your comments on the air. Also, quick plug, on Thursday, October 15th, 8 p.m., I will be doing my solo show, Harmon Leon Infiltrates Trump America. It's all about my true life exploits, going out undercover in disguise and infiltrating the complete shit show, which is Trump America. Yes, I hope after November I will never have to do this show ever again. Hope there's some changes in the White House. Once again, it'll be 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can check it out on twitch.tv/comedyhistory101. And now, without further ado,
everybody's so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured the audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.
When you're working in these places, we mentioned several of them, you don't get paid. Does that ever bug you to feel you're like you're getting ripped off, you're working for nothing?
Oh, I always get paid. I don't know about Dottie and Mulder here, but I've always been paid. I'm making quite a substantial income.
No, seriously, does it ever bother you?
It never bothered me. You accept it. What are you going to do?
It's a great showcase there. You know, both the places around are good because this is where the industry is.
So, hearing that clip, what's your takeaway on that?
That they don't...
Like, if you look at Letterman's sort of kind of body language in that YouTube clip, you look very uncomfortable when the host of whatever show that was asked him, you don't get paid. Does that ever bother you that you don't get paid?
What, and what, for the audience at home, describe what he was doing, like, body-wise.
He's wearing, like, 70s clothes.
Right,
and
yeah.
He just sort of, okay, so... what I learned from covering poker, a tell is when you start touching your face, when you feel uncomfortable, you know. So he was doing some tells that he wasn't happy with the host of that show, which is a clip from, like, a rare clip from, I would say, like, probably about mid to, like, maybe around 1977. He didn't like the question posed to him that you know, you don't get paid when you do sets at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
But that leads into what we're talking about today is the history of the Comedy Store strike. So once again, I am Harmon Leon, and with me is...
I am Scott Colonico, robot from across the pond.
And this, in case you want to know, is the podcast Comedy History 101. So today we're going to talk about the history of the is it famous or infamous Comedy Store strike of 1979.
I think you could say it would both be a little famous and infamous at the same time. If you could be both things, is what it would be.
Yeah. So the Comedy Store strike was it was this kind of turning point in comedy history, where comedy went from being fun and we're practicing our art to that change in stand-up comedy where it was suddenly like a business and comedians should be paid.
Right, yeah, as opposed to treating it as a college. I think that was the Comedy Store owner's point of reference.
Yeah, but you got to realize, so early 70s stand-up comedy, like modern-day stand-up comedy, was sort of reinvented. Like, back before that, it was like comedians in Vegas. It was like the old school, like Buddy Hackett, Don Rickles, Shecky Green. There was clubs like, you know, the Hungry Eye and the Purple Onion, you know, San Francisco, and of course, you know, all those great comedy clubs that were like in Greenwich Village. But this was like a changing of the guard, because like Mitzi was the first to create like the modern day comedy club.
Right. Yeah, and along the way, kind of as one of the comedians there was pointing out, kind of the modern day, the idea of the modern comedy kind of lineup, kind of a rapid fire series of comics going on right one after the other.
Yeah, she kind of changed like comedy as we see today, kind of like she took the model of the strip club.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which I feel like when I'm on a bill and there's way too many comedians. It gets that feeling, and the Comedy Store was like perfect for that, because I don't know if you've ever been in the Comedy Store on the Sunset Strip, but it's kind of has that danky, like it's a dark black wall painted place, and it kind of has that strip club sort of feeling. So just backtracking a bit, the Comedy Store opened in 1972 by old school comedian Sammy Shore. It was a 99-seat room on Sunset Boulevard, and it once housed the legendary club Ciro's. Do you know anything about Ciro's?
Apparently the mob guys used to hang out there. That's
Bugsy Siegel.
Bugsy Siegel. Somebody was shot in front of it. I just saw it. Mo.
Oh, really?
Mo somebody? Yeah. Apparently one of the big mob dudes was shot right in front.
Yeah, so it was like, you know, a place where like you would see like Liza Minnelli hanging out, kind of like an old school kind of nightclub.
Yeah.
But 1972, Sammy Shore opened the Comedy Store, and Sammy Shore was married to Mitzi Shore. That wasn't her maiden name.
No, that was her.
No. And she began operating the club in either 1973 or 1974. But basically, Sammy and Mitzi divorced, and instead of paying like higher alimony payment, he just gave her the club and Pauly Shore. Because that's their kid.
Yeah, he got that in the deal. Or she did.
Yeah, so what she did was she officially bought the building in 1976. And she rebuilt the room to focus on the stage, took out the bar. She made customers order drinks from waitresses, established the club 2-drink minimum, and thus, i.e., the modern comedy club was invented.
I was clapping. So the club was ground zero for stand-up in the late 70s. Some of the people that got their starts there are Jay Leno, David Letterman, Richard Pryor. Well, Richard Pryor had to start elsewhere, but he would drop in at the Comedy Store every once in a while to work on new material. Robin Williams, Michael Keaton, Jimmy Walker, Richard Lewis. Oh, my God, my tongue's already tired. Richard Belcher, Elaine Boozler, Paul Mooney, Gary Shanley, and Marsha Warfield, among others, in addition to whenever other podcast co-hosts. Mark Maron had a brief stint there as the doorman at the Comedy Store.
But yeah, like I said, so stand-up in the early 70s was mostly revolved around two cities. It was like New York, Las Vegas. This club opened up the Comedy Store, 72. And another big change that changed comedy was in May of that year, Johnny Carson moved The Tonight Show from New York to Burbank.
From Hollywood, The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson. This is Ed McMahon along with Doc Severinsen and the NBC Orchestra inviting you to join Johnny and his guests, Buddy Hackett, John Lithgow, and another segment of Moron Movies. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
And that also changed the whole dynamic of club comedy at the Comedy Store, because in 1973, an unknown Freddie Prinze did a spot at the Comedy Store, and that won him a spot on The Tonight Show, and because of that, he became the star of Chico and the Man.
Cockroaches are strong. You can't kill them. You ever notice? You step on them, you hear them snap. As soon as you lift your foot, they run like hell. That's because they know we believe the snap means they're dead, so they're going, chump, and they're gone.
Chico and the Man with Jack Albertson from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
And also Scatman Crothers from The Shining.
Oh, yeah, Scatman was in there, too. Yeah, he was.
Yeah, he's great in The Shining.
But he wasn't in. He wasn't the man. I think that was Jack Albertson, Anderson.
Yeah, he wasn't the man.
No, he wasn't.
But he's the man, as in a cool actor.
Yeah, he was. Yes, Freddie Prinze, father of Freddie Prinze Jr.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, one interesting thing to shift away from Freddie Prinze Jr. for a bit. An interesting thing that people were talking. So yeah, it was kind of like this snowball effect because you had Freddie Prinze go up on the Tonight Show with Carson, and then Johnny would say, "Oh, by the way, you can see this young man performing at the Comedy Store here in Los Angeles." And so that would just be, you know, people watching this at home who were aspiring comedians would see this and go, "Oh, well, that's the place I need to be, is to go to the Comedy Store."
Yeah, and that was like what David Letterman said in one of those old interview clips. Mm-hmm. Like, he'd be listening back in Indiana. It's like, I want to make it as a comedian. And all these comedians that are on The Tonight Show, it sounds like they all perform at the Comedy Store.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly it became like that was like the place to go. If you're a comedian, you would do the Comedy Store with the chance of getting on The Tonight Show. And isn't it like crazy that that was the only show in town? Like, TV show.
Yeah, that was...
I mean, it was like, if you were on The Tonight Show back in the 70s and you kill it, and Johnny tells you to come over to the couch, you were like a made man.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, it was interesting. That was you had the gatekeepers.
Yeah, and it was like, it was such a gatekeeper. And because of that, Mitzi saw herself as sort of like a den mother for these inspiring comedians. She thought of like the Comedy Store was like a college for comedians. And she thought, you know, which was sort of true, that, you know, she's giving these comedians an opportunity to like work on their craft and possibly, you know, get discovered. She would like... you know, make phone calls on behalf of some of the comedians or lend them money. She took some on vacations with her. That sounds a little dodgy.
We'll get into that. I've did some research on this.
So that's what she thought. She thought, you know, okay, I'm providing this training ground for comedians. But how did things change? Like, Mitzi's goal was to make the main room of the Comedy Store, like, for Vegas acts like Buddy Hackett.
It is very seldom that at a prenuptial dinner, a trunk dick reaches for a potato. And the mother said, I don't know what I saw. Could you do that again? He said, I could, but I don't know if there's room in my ass for another potato.
So she thought, like, the main room would be like this Vegas showroom. And then the original room would be for the up-and-coming comics, but the established Vegas acts didn't want to play the Comedy Store because they thought that would ruin their draw, like in Vegas. So the main room and the original room all became Mitzi's, like, regular Comedy Store players. The only problem is no one was getting paid, and you would have comedians like Jay Leno and Letterman, you know, opening for Sammy Davis Jr. in the same size room in Las Vegas, and making like $10,000 a week, and then they come back to the same size room in Los Angeles, and they'd be making $0.
Right, yeah, so they're like, well, wait a minute, why? And it is kind of a little crazy. It's just like, where were all the money going again?
Yeah, it was Letterman's friend, what's his name, comedian George Miller.
There's no receipts at the Motel 3. When you give him the money for the room rent, there's no receipts. Instead, the same guy followed me around night and day. Yeah, he paid. Yeah, he paid. Yeah, he paid.
Do you remember him at all?
No, I don't. I heard somebody talking about it. I was trying to do... Yeah, his mom was the bookkeeper.
Yeah, so that was another, like, kind of slap in the face for the comedians, was that George Miller, who was a, you know... He was like Letterman's best friend, like when they were up and coming. But his mom did Mitzi's books, and she was just making bank off the place.
Right. So those guys didn't feel very welcome that they weren't making money. I think one of the what you were talking about when you were talking about the when she was setting up the new room, it was a suggestion of a comedian by the name of Argus Hamilton and a friend of his, Biff Maynard, who said, they said, hey, what, Mitzi, that, you know, if you get the big room sitting there, why don't you put up some of your, you know, the regulars, or meaning us, the guys who've been sitting around here working our acts, you know, see if we can fill the main room. And that's when she would do the, you know, you do the rapid fire, you know, people going up one after another, the strip style show. And then Argus was one of he was supposed to be the up and coming comedian. The guy had a pretty good career until the 80s, but he was stupid with Mitzi at the time as well. So that's what he was.
and what does stupid mean?
That means he's boning her.
Oh, right, but I was
using it like comedian talk. Stupid.
Yeah, no, that's fine. And if you look at, I checked out like some of his videos, like, or stand-up appearances on YouTube. It, comedy doesn't age that well. It was kind of like airline jokes.
Yeah, it's
I
just,
fly a small airline, a small budget airline. Yeah.
We had this. Well, he was from Oklahoma, and that was his deal. That was what he does. The thing that they tell you to do in comedy stand-up schools: they talk about where you're from.
Yeah, but he was on the Tonight Show, like, and you talk about, like, you know, passing the gatekeeper. He was on the Tonight Show more than 20 times.
Yeah, I know. They thought he was going to be, you know, he thought that he was tapped as kind of the next Johnny.
Yeah, he was sort of Letterman-ish. It's kind of like, okay, kind of Midwestern. Yeah. I don't know. Is Oklahoma Midwest? But, you know, that's where, like, Johnny was from. Where was he from? Missouri or?
Who? Oh, Johnny Carson. Yeah, I think he was around Missouri. Or no, he was from Nebraska, I think.
Yeah, he was from Nebraska. No, Letterman was from Indiana. Yeah. This guy was from Oklahoma.
Yeah.
But it says here, a little trivia fact, his career was derailed in the 80s by a crippling fondness for cocaine and booze.
Oh, no. That all happened to the best of them.
Yeah, but then it was getting like crazy. So Freddie Prinze, you know, he got Chico and the Man. Robin Williams got discovered there. And he got, you know, Mork and Mindy. Jimmy J.J. Walker played the Comedy Store. And then he was on Good Times.
And a smile that lights up the night. And it all belongs to Kid Dynamite!
So it came to this part where Mitzi was making so much money off the regulars who weren't getting paid. And, you know, again, it's kind of like people in comedy clubs just have that mentality of, like, you know, you're just lucky to be here and get the stage time, which in some cases is true. But it's just like, even to this day, it's just like club owners just take advantage of comedians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's and then somebody, well, we'll get into it more later, but we'll talk about power and money. Go ahead.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, you can talk about Power and Money. We can always, gonna come into with the power
later.
Of editing.
I didn't want to jump into it right now. But yeah, but just when you hear, because basically, you know, after the comedians came forward, they said, here's our demands, or here's my requests, and what, and it was pretty, you know, $25 a show is pretty, you know, it's not.
No, it was even like, just, can you pay them $5 for gas money?
Yeah, it was even, it's like that, and then it's more... For her, you can see it's more of a power thing. It's not really even about the money. It's about, I had this statement, and I'm right. This is a college, and you should be here for free. And, like, that you just weren't going to – somebody wasn't going to budge.
Oh, my God. Like, in New York, there's, like – I know this – I've heard of this guy who runs kind of, like, the BC rooms. And, well, first of all, there's that whole thing in New York where, okay, you want to get 5 minutes of stage time, you have to go around Times Square and try to get people to sell tickets.
Right, bark, yeah.
For free.
Yeah, okay.
Or you want to get stage time? Okay, then you have to bring seven of your paying friends.
The bringer shows.
Yeah, and we still won't pay it.
Yeah, no, exactly.
But there's one guy, he runs like these BC rooms, and it's not Beat Before Christ rooms. Like, you yeah. know, they're kind of on the lower end of the rooms. And a friend of mine was telling me he actually has a driver who's an open micer to drive him around.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Like, I tried once to arrange, like, you know, because I produce shows, like, to arrange, like, a show there. So I met with, like, his, like, and this is in quotes, his assistant, who was just an open micer that he got, like, as an assistant, who he doesn't pay, you know. So it's, like, even to this day, it's just, like, you know, people just take advantage of – I don't necessarily think that's across comedy. It's across, like, people – who prey on people's vulnerabilities and know they can exploit them.
Right, exactly.
But so the comedians, they felt they were being exploited. So in March 1979, the Comedy Store regulars formed kind of a quasi-union called Comedians for Compensation and went on a six-week strike right in front on the Sunset Boulevard. And they were led by comedian Tom Dreesen, who was a former like union leader in Chicago.
You know who have the best names in our society, though? Really, Indians have very good names, descriptive names like Iron Eyes and Running Bear. Imagine if we all had names like that. Hi, I'm Hook Nose. These are my daughters, Padded Bra and Tinted Hair.
Yeah, and Tom, interesting. He was a teamster for a while in Chicago, and when he started doing stand up, he was part of a comedy duo with Tim Reed. Now, I don't know if you remember who Tim Reed, but he is probably most famous as Venus Flytrap from WKRP.
Oh yeah. I remember reading this somewhere, and they were like, so Tim Reed's an African American, and Tom. Yeah. Dreesen's a white guy, and they actually would break.
Yeah, they were the first biracial comedy team, and they started back in the 60s. And like one of their Dreesen's joke to this day still is they were the first and last biracial comedy team,
according to Tom Dreesen.
To Tom Dreesen, yeah.
Yeah. So they formed a picket line in front of the Comedy Store, and they had like picket signs that would say things like "No money, no funny," and of course, the yuck stops here. But so the news picked up on this, like not only like did the LA Times, but like the local news, and they just thought, okay, we'll spin this of an angle. How funny is this? These stand-up comedians are picketing on the picket line. So that was like kind of a, you know, like a water skiing squirrel news story to them.
Yeah, exactly. There was a let's see if I can. I'll give his last name pronunciation a try. Bill Nodelsader. He was the LA Times reporter who covered comedy. And, yeah, he said, you know, they kind of started out as kind of the wacky comedians on strike thing. And then he was a Comedy Store regular, so all the comedians, like, knew him and everything. And he said he was there covering the strike, and Elaine Boozer got really mad, came up to him, and she was like, you know, it's not a joke, you know, this is a real deal. Because it did go on for a few weeks.
And what was interesting is when they decided to do this, when particularly Tom and Jay, who didn't really need the money,
right.
they decided to ask for money on behalf of the people who weren't making that money, who were living out of their cars and, you know, eating meals at the buffet at the bar. You know?
Tom Dresden was one of those people who had been living out of his car.
Right, exactly. He remembered.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, it went on. Well, yeah, I mean, the strike went on for a few weeks, but it was like, you know, it went on for years that comedians wouldn't get paid. And Tom Dresden suggested, you know, okay, how about simply this? Your cover charge is $4.50. Why don't you just add $1 to your cover charge, and you split that extra dollar, you know, made off of each ticket amongst the comedians. So if you have a couple hundred people in the club on a given night, that meant, you know, $200 to split amongst comedians in 1979 money. So,
right, yeah,
you know, you could get something to eat, or, you know, just pay your gas. Because, like, in L.A., it's like you have to drive everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and if you can't afford, you don't have any money, it's not like jumping on a New York subway. It's like, all right, you're kind of trapped, and you drive all the way down to the Comedy Store,
and you don't
you know,
get
you're
a
walking
kid,
away
yeah.
with no money.
Wow. Okay. So just to I just did some historical calculations here with the Comedy History 101 computer. And so the like you were saying, so the cover price in 1979 for the Comedy Store was $3.50, which would be it's over $10. That's about $12-$13 today.
Yeah, so that was pretty reasonable. But, yeah, you know, comedy clubs make all their money off of drinks. So
right, exactly.
That's why the two-drink minimum. And, like, a drink to make, like, even if it's the most expensive drink, would cost the club, like, actually, like, you know, 35 cents.
Right, and then you've got the two-drink minimum tied in there.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, it's you're paying some money. So that was, you know, the formula that Mitzi created for the club was with that. But Mitzi came back and just flatly said no.
Right, yeah. She was just like I said, that was my point. It was all about control. It was about her. She said something, you know, she made her point. That's how it is. You guys suck it up.
Yeah, so at the time, like, Letterman was starting to come into his own, and he actually guest hosted The Tonight Show in 1979.
Thank you. How many of you folks here have never been to a TV studio before? Applaud if you've never been to one of these things. Okay. How many of you have been here before? Applaud if you have been here before. Okay. All right, now how many of you who have never been here before today are here with somebody who has been here before? Okay, now, listen carefully. This gets a little confusing at this point. Huh? How many of you out of that last group are in this country illegally? Could we just hear? Great, fine.
And right after he got done guest hosting The Tonight Show, he would go back in front of the Comedy Store and join the picket line. And Jay Leno was another guy really instrumental in the comedy strike.
I'm originally from the United States. Any United States people here tonight? Oh, what a small world. Isn't that funny, no matter where you're from? Right.
Yeah, he was... David Letterman has a really funny story about... Jay was very excited about the strike. And during the first meeting they had... He was just, like, constantly running around the room, getting all excited. And when Letterman had a story where it was saying that when Dreesen was in front of the room, like, you know, addressing everybody, Leno would hang out behind him and, like he was signing, like he was doing so everybody would understand what Dreesen was saying, you know? So and David's joke, Letterman's joke was that, okay, the first strike meeting went well, why don't we just not tell Jay where the second meeting's going to be?
Yeah, it sounded like Leno was, like, really annoying.
Yeah.
But they did receive some accolades. Like, Bob Hope sent a telegram to Tom Dresden that said, Dear Tom, congratulations and go get 'em. So, you know, even, like, the old school guard was behind, you know, comedians getting paid.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, Letterman was all behind it. Richard Lewis was behind it. He didn't want to pick it at first because, you know, the quote was, he didn't want to say, I need your $20 to, you know, to him, that was just kind of trivial. But once, you know, once he started seeing the bigger picture that some people were making more money and the artists weren't making any money, then he was like, you know, this is bullshit, you know.
Yeah, he was standing up for the comedians that weren't making money.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it was like that watershed year too, where you had that whole split where people were, you know, some people were making a lot of money, and there were some people who were still, you know, working their way up there.
Yeah, I mean, because basically there was just the Tonight Show and Vegas.
Right. Yeah.
And it was before the 80s comedy boom, where there was like comedy clubs in every shopping mall. Mm-hmm. And Mitzi said that when Letterman joined the strike, that was the moment that like crushed her, because she sort of took Letterman on early, and she would look like, when he was like ready to pack it in and move back to Indiana, she was the one that was like, you know, really encouraging to Letterman.
Yeah.
And when she saw him join the picket line, that's what like really choked her up.
I just asked Dave, you've been working at the Comedy Store, and I says, how's it going? You said, well, you'd be rather be working other places for real money.
Yeah, the Comedy Store is a great place to go. You get an audience and you work out new material. I've been there for 3 years, and but after a while you get the itch to go out and earn some dough. So
and he said, so she called him, and he said, you know, these comedians are my friends, and they'll be my friends for the rest of my life. And, you know, he just had to stick by the comedians.
Yeah, so as the strike went on, eventually they had to try to figure out how to break this thing up. And so our old buddy Argus Hamilton comes back in, and he starts negotiating as her representative with the comedians. So his proposal was that they'd pay the comedians $25 a head or per set in the original room.
Yeah, but she just said no. What does this mean? Argus Hamilton webpage.
Oh, I was just saying.
Is he still around?
Yes, he's still around. He does like corporate gigs and stuff, and you have to go look at his page, because it looks really.
Let me look at it right now.
Yeah, it looks really bad, but it's updated.
What is this?
It was updated last week, but he's still using frames, which is
no. But he's using those bad squiggly American flag GIFs.
It's like you would think that it's like this really old site, but like look at the last news item is from last week.
Yeah, copyright 2017.
Yeah, the last news item actually was from Friday, the last news item on there. So,
ugh.
Yeah. He just needs Argus.
Oh, this is sad. And Argus, the photo he uses is like him from the 80s.
I know, dude. Argus, if you're listening, we know a couple good ones.
Email Argus. Oh, my God. Oh, God. And there's like, oh. And his photos are just way out of date.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Poor guy with his cocaine and.
Like, he was sober. He got sober like right after well, we'll get to that in a little bit. But he got sober, and apparently he's been sober for a long time.
Yeah. So as the strike dragged on, there were some people that kind of crossed the picket lines. And surprisingly, do you know who one of them was?
No, I don't. Tell me. What's the other word for these people?
What's that?
What's the other word for these people?
Strikebreakers, scabs.
Yeah, there you go. I wanted to hear you get ugly.
Yeah, yeah. So, and one of the scabs was Yakov Smirnoff.
Oh my God, Yakov.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured audience. They're not going anywhere.
But we didn't know any better.
Yeah, he's like, in the U.S., you pick a comedy club, but in Russia, comedy club pickets you.
It says my name, Smirnoff. Welcome, what a country.
Yeah. But so Mitzi proposed, like, a settlement for, like, the comics that she would pay them $25 as a set on the weekends, but the weekends only. And another one of the guys who crossed the picket lines was Gary Shandling.
I love going to the laundromat because you see people wearing the last thing they want to wear. Have you ever noticed that? People are wearing Bermuda shorts and a Nehru jacket. And I just don't want to see that.
Fine. And mm-hmm. Gary came from a family with strong anti-union values.
All right, pro-union.
No, strong. What does this mean? Strong anti-union views.
That's bad.
Oh, okay. He was against unions.
Oh, okay. Well, then, yeah. Then that's not really a surprise. Then.
Yeah. So that was like another. That was a moment on, you know, during the 6 week strike that was really disheartening to those who were striking, because, you know, Shandling was one of the big acts at the time.
Mm-hmm.
John Witherspoon was a doorman. He acted as like a marshal on the picket line and protected the strikers from, you know, being harassed by Mitzi's, like, loyal comedians that would still perform at the club.
Yeah, and so what you had, somebody who jumped in to help, quote-unquote, as one of the, as a friend, quote-unquote, of the strikers was Bud Friedman, who ran the improv down in Melrose, right? It's Melrose.
Yeah, so yeah. The improv moved, as if as you might remember from our very first episode of Comedy History Number 101, was the improv moved from New York to L.A., and he positioned himself saying, you know, I will match whatever settlement Mitzi agrees to. So he positioned himself as a friend to the strikers. In a weird twist, during the strike, the improv burnt down. It caught fire.
Uh-oh, mystery.
And they never knew what caused it. And one of the rumors was that it was a disgruntled person on the strike line that and because of the strike, that's why someone torched the improv.
Think it was Jay Leno, maybe?
No, I think Jay was there and actually helped like repaint the new improv, if you remember from that episode.
Okay,
we did.
That's right. Yeah. Maybe it was Yakov Smirnoff.
That like, I think we made the same joke in the same episode.
Oh, did we? I'm trying to pin this on someone.
In the U.S., you torch down comedy torch club, but in you. Russia, comedy club torches you down. So when the strike really became ugly was one night an anti-strike comic tried to drive his car through the picket line and they wouldn't let him in. And his car brushed against some of the comics and it knocked Jay Leno to the pavement with a loud thud.
Ooh.
Yeah, so Tom Dreesen ran over, panicked, and to see if like Leno was like seriously injured, and Leno like gave him a wink. And it turned out that he thumped the car with his hand.
Okay.
But he was still hauled off to the hospital in an ambulance afterwards, and that kind of incident seemed to sober everyone up. And within 10 minutes of this happening, Mitzi got on the phone to Tom Dreesen and said, "Let's settle this thing now."
All right. So do we – one question before we move on. We don't know who the driver of the car was, huh?
I didn't see who, but I don't think Leno was like really injured, but right, it just kind of showed that, okay, this thing's like escalating too far and you don't really want, you know, a comedian getting hurt because, you know, she was still, you know, these were still her comics, you know, that kind of helped build the Comedy Store, you know, like Leno and Letterman.
So what was the settlement?
So on May 4th, 1979, a settlement was reached that so the comedians would be paid like $25 per set, and new comedians or newcomers, you know, they would work something out. So the performers got 50% of the door in the main room, which is the big comedy room, or $25 a set in the smaller original room.
Okay, well, and we'll hear, according to the Comedy History 101 computer, it's actually not bad. $25 in 1979 is $84 today, so almost $100 for
doing... Yeah, so anyways, one of the big comedy clubs in town is the Comic Strip on Upper East Side, and I think they only pay $35 a set.
Like right now?
In 2017 dollar money.
Do you want me to figure that out?
Yeah, but even the Comedy Cellar is about the same.
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah. Yeah. Cause,
so. Mm-hmm. Well, these are showcase cities, you know. So
right, yeah.
These clubs can get away with that kind of money because, again, it's a showcase format. It's not like a headliner, middle, whatever.
Right,
it's like, you know, you get a lineup of 10 comedians. And, you know, like the Comedy Cellar's lineups are all, you know, people you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah, just going out and seeing. So it was pretty good. So it was not, you know, that's not a bad, $25 isn't bad for 1979.
Yeah, so at least the comics were getting paid, but there was some still bitterness because of it. And because of, like, some comedians that were on the picket line, they just found they would get less stage time.
Oh, okay.
And Mitzi complained that she could no longer afford to keep her rooms running on slow nights, so she would shut down her Westwood comedy room on the weekdays and reduced the number of time slots at the Sunset Club, which meant less work for the comedians.
Mm. So what was there any other negative fallouts to the strike?
You tell me, man.
Okay. yeah, well, so kind of the nadir of the strike would be the incident of Steve Lubetkin. Lubetkin, is that how we're saying it?
Yeah, we could just call him that.
I think that was it.
The guy is no longer with us, so
yes,
show us respect.
All due respect. Yeah. Steve Lubetkin. He was a New York comic, originally started out in New York with Richard Belzer and moved out to L.A. And
he is Richard Lewis's best friend.
Richard Lewis's best friend. And he moved out to L.A. to make it big in the business. And so he would start doing stand-up sets. And he was doing okay for a while. And then, like, before the strike, he kind of had this... I can't remember who was saying it. It was just... it was just an epic string of really bad luck where, like, for one night he had been booked a show on Johnny Carson, The Tonight Show, and they said, "Okay, you're on, you're great, we're going to do you." And then he was on stage at the store one night and kind of working out a new joke where he wasn't doing his, like, you know, set, his normal set, and just kind of screwing around, trying out new material. And one of the scouts from The Tonight Show was in the audience that night that he didn't know about. And the scout was like, you know, this guy sucks. So they wound up canceling that gig. He had a couple other gigs where I think one of his, he was supposed to be on, it was like some variety show, and then it got preempted by when Nixon went to China.
Really?
Yeah.
I never heard that. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was like they made a, because it was weird, because I was just watching it on that Vietnam special, you know, where they showed the TV clip. But yeah, it preempted all the news and everything. Nixon said he was going to China, and that's when Lubetkin was about to go up, or he was going up, and so that got cut. And then there was some other variety show he was on that the bit just wound, the whole bit wound up getting cut. So he just had this really crazy string of bad luck. And apparently he had scraped together $15,000, and he roped Rick. He's kind of like a pre-indie film dude, where he scraped together $15,000. He wrote, directed, and starred in his own indie movie called Dante Shocko, which was never released. And a lot of people are trying to look for. I wonder if there's a copy of it. But I saw some people tweeting about it, but nobody can nobody can seem to locate this movie, because that'd be kind of interesting to see.
Was Richard Lewis in it?
I don't know. Might have been. Might be. I didn't see it in the IMDb, so that'd become that could be.
Yeah, because I checked out his IMDb, and all it had was he was a PA on the game show The Smart Alex,
right,
hosted by Alan Ludden, and David Letterman was a regular on that.
Yeah, so that was his you know, he kind of bounced around. He was kind of doing okay. He was doing pretty well, and then the strike happened, and it kind of seemed to push him over the edge. This whole big long string of bad luck, and then the strike happened, and then obviously putting $15,000 into a movie. Yeah, it's $50,000 in today's money into a movie that never gets released. So he wasn't in probably in the best mental frame of mind, and then the strike came along, and Dreesen kind of put him in charge. Like, while Dreesen had to go out of town to do some gigs, and he put Lubetkin in charge while he was gone, and Lubetkin, some people think that was too much for him to handle. He couldn't handle everything with what was going on in his life, and he wound up climbing to the top of the Riot Hyatt, which is right next door to the Comedy Store, and jumped off the top from the top roof, the top of a 15-story building, and landed in the parking lot of the Comedy Store.
Yeah, right in the ramp.
Yep.
But also leading up to that was after the strike, like, Mitzi wouldn't put him on
the Comedy Store. That was the thing. I forgot to add that part. Yeah, he kept calling, and she wouldn't put him on. And that was to go back what we were talking to about earlier, where there was one, you know, that was the Tonight Show, and that was the outlet. And if you couldn't get on, you know, if you couldn't get in the Comedy Store, you couldn't get seen for the Tonight Show. You could, you know, your career was going nowhere. So, you know, you can see how that might upset somebody.
God, like, just think of, like, you know, when there was just one show and that was it, and then you think, oh, all right, now I'm not at the one club.
I know.
And that was it. That's, like, all your options.
I know. And the thing is, you know, there are probably I wish we had some of his comedy that we could watch. And obviously, if he was friends with other comedians, then he must not have been really shitty. Because if he was a really bad comic, you know, people wouldn't have been. But you got to imagine, there must have been some bad comics. The people that just Mitzi liked for some reason, that would just go up at the store.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's weird.
I'd be curious to see a whole set list from those guys.
Well, I also think of, like, there's these people that were, you know, like your Argus Hamiltons, but, like, with even less creds, that were, like, the, you know, the club legend that never made it. And they were, like, you know, the huge. I think I remember listening to a Pauly Shore interview. Pauly Shore actually gives good interviews.
Yeah, no, he does.
He's got, and I think it was, like, a guy named Ollie Joe Frater or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Just saying, he was, like, the best club comic I've ever seen. You know, and just never made it, you know?
Yeah, and then there were the ones that, like, Ollie Joe Prater, yeah, that was it. Yeah, that was the guy's name. He was a 300-pound-plus bearded Midwesterner, and he was friends with, like, Dice and all those guys. Yeah,
yeah.
But then there were the guys that, like, kind of made it, who, like, I think Marin talks about this, like, looking at, you'd see some of the stars, you know, they'd have their headshots hanging on the wall. And there was one guy that I looked up, and his deal was that, like, he would go on stage with, like, a lunchbox. I can't remember his name, but it was kind of like a real 70s thing. And I saw
We talked about him before. I forgot his name.
I saw clips of him on the Dinah Shore show, and it was like, that is something that doesn't hold up.
Yeah, just comedy that doesn't age well. Yeah. It's just like, yeah. So when Steve Lebetkin jumped off into the Comedy Store parking lot, he had a suicide note that said, "My name is Steve Lebetkin. I used to work at the Comedy Store."
Ugh, ow.
Not creepy at all. So the next day, after the suicide, Mitzi walks into her office, and she saw a poster of Lebetkin propped on her couch with the words "Got the message" scrawled in magic marker on her wall.
Damn.
Like, it was put there by Lebetkin's girlfriend.
Dude.
And I've heard this story. I've heard this story for several years after, on the anniversary of his suicide, someone would go into Mitzi's office and put Steve Lebetkin's headshot on her desk.
Damn.
Yeah, dude, that's harsh.
Yeah.
So basically, that was sort of a turning point for both comedy and Mitzi. Like, after that, she just became this hardened sort of club owner.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that was like the turning point, and sort of the aftermath of the strike was, you know, comedians are professional and should be paid.
Right, yeah. And then that's what it's like, also you're saying, where she kind of turned over a lot of the club runnings. I mean, I'm sure she still kind of helped him with the financial stuff, but as far as, like, the bookings and seeing who was going on, and who, she kind of started turning that over to kind of the comics.
Yeah. So after that, you know, she stopped referring to her club as a school or college, you know? And it was same with, like, other comedy clubs where, you know, people are making millions, but the reason that the people are there at the establishment are the first place is because of the comedians who should be paid, because that's what's really paying, you know, the wait staff and the bartenders and all that. It's, you know, the comedians that are on stage. So what are the takeaways from the Comedy Store strike of 1979?
Pay your comedians.
Yeah. Like Elaine Boozer, she said she would not go on stage at the Comedy Store until she was paid first, full in cash, and that was all kind of part of the strike.
Yeah, that kind of, because I had from friends that ran an ill-fated comedy club back in Austin, the Bad Dog Comedy Club, which was pretty big. I mean, that was probably 200 or 300 seat. It might have been more. It might have been 400 seat. It was a pretty big club, but I remember, like, Margaret Cho was gonna be, like, their first big headliner, and she would not go on stage until they gave her a bag full of cash. You know, they
said, yeah, I mean, it was kind of fly by. Well, it's probably because, like, the club got a reputation.
Yeah.
And like maybe a comedian was there and their check bounced. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to be the guy having to chase down money. And so you book in someone big like Margaret Cho. And it's like, all right, but she doesn't want to have her check bounce. So it's like, you booked me and this is our agreement, you know, pay me a bag full of money because I don't have the reputation for bouncing checks.
Yeah, yeah. And that was, you know, along the same lines. You had a friend who worked at the rock club in Austin, too. And like they wouldn't, like, I think it was Queens of the Stone Age or someone. Like they literally wouldn't go on stage until they'd phoned their bank and seen the balance like into their account. So, which, you know, fair enough. It's all, that's you got to get paid.
You got to get paid. And I think, you know, that the repercussions of the Comedy Store strike, you know, led to the comedy boom of the 80s, where every place turned into a comedy venue and everyone was getting paid. But then it was like oversaturation of, okay, bad performers are getting paid. Bad comedians are making livings and they're desaturating the quality, where back in the Comedy Store days, only – you know, the Comedy Store regulars were getting paid.
Right. Yeah, so more comedy, more comics getting paid. Maybe not all good.
Yeah, so I think the takeaway was you had kind of coming out of like the 60s and the 70s, you had a bunch of frustrated victims of an outdated structure that banded together because of their values to make their voices heard of a changing of the guard and redefine the rules of the game.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I like that. I like the way that's summed up.
Yeah. All right. So how do we wrap things up?
Well, plug away, dude. Plug away. And
So, yeah, I think that does it for this episode of
Comedy History 101.
Scott, do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Well, you can go check out our podcast on our website, Words Over Chair. Yep, that's our new website, Words Over Chair, for our production company. You can also find the podcast on all your favorite podcast broadcasting platforms, such as Google Play and iTunes. We're also popping up in other places like Stitcher.
Stitcher.
And, yep, Last FM as well. So you can find us there. And you know, the thing is, you know, when you listen to a podcast, Harmon, what do you do afterwards?
I donate money.
Okay, okay.
Because much like the comedians of 1979 at the Comedy Store, it's good to get paid. If you appreciate the podcast and how much we dig into the history of the Comedy Store and other topics, throw in like a dollar or a fiver. It helps us to buy like pens and papers so we can jot down notes to find out. And you can do that. You can do that at our site, Words Over Cheer. What I just did is the bucket speech.
That was a good bucket speech. But I also was going to say, in addition to donating, people, you know, if you rate us, that's almost as good as a donation. If you rate us, leave a comment. Hopefully it's good. You know, maybe even a suggestion of what you want to hear next over here on Comedy History 101. We also have our Twitter, which is @WordsOverChair. Check us out. Tweet at us. Say hi to us. And also, we have another podcast that Harmon and I do as well that's called This Is the President, where we go over historical presidential speeches, phone calls, press conferences. Believe me, it's a lot more entertaining than it sounds. It's like history. It's history and presidents all wrapped in one, because we always compare it to our current president, which is, you know, you can't go wrong. You can't go wrong with comedy value on that.
Exactly. And once again, thanks for tuning in. And like us and rate us on iTunes. Thanks a lot.
All right, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured the audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.